Hello and welcome to the Third Sector podcast. I'm Rebecca Cooney, Senior Features and Analysis Writer.
And I'm Liam Kay, Senior Reporter at Third Sector, the UK's leading publication for the voluntary and not-for-profit sector.
Each month we're delving a little deeper into some of the conversations being had in our community, learning more about exciting innovations and probing some of the issues we're facing.
This month we'll be discussing online fundraising platforms and crowdfunding and the impact they've had on charity fundraising. We'll be chatting to Joe Barnett, Chief Executive of Virgin Money Giving, Marcus Misson, Director of Fundraising at WaterAid, and Gerald Oppenheim, Chief Executive of the Fundraising Regulator and Chair of the London Emergencies Trust.
And in the wake of controversies about Katy Perry being named an ambassador for the British Asian Trust and Prince Andrew taking a step back from around 80 royal patronages, we'll also be hearing from Paul Curran, a charity celebrity management consultant, about the benefits and risks of celebrity patrons.
And we'll hear from charity digital consultant and Third Sector columnist Zoe Ammer at the Third Sector Technology Summit earlier this month, talking about the progress charities have made in using digital technology.
So Liam, you're a man that's known to enjoy the pub. What would you say the clientele at your local are like?
A bit of a mixed bag, but like a second family.
Okay, you wouldn't say they're prickly customers or, you know, they're having a bit of a ball.
Is this about the Hibernation Arms?
It's totally about the Hibernation Arms. We want to talk about the Hibernation Arms. So for those of you that didn't see the story, Camden Town Brewery has a partnership with the British Hedgehog Preservation Society. And what they did was they created a range of pub-shaped hideaways for hedgehogs.
Very, very beautiful looking pub-shaped hideaways, I have to say.
Yeah, properly detailed, intricate. So these hideaways were not just for the hedgehogs to go for a drink, although, you know,
I hope they partaked a little bit.
Yes, but they are basically places for the hedgehogs to hide out, to hibernate, and in the winter, because apparently they're really struggling. Apparently hedgehogs are struggling to hibernate because of changing environments and traffic and things like that. And also somewhere for them to give birth to baby hedgehogs. Hoglets.
Oh.
They're called hoglets. And the partnership has raised about £10,000 so far. So as well as these hideaways, they've been one of their beers. Have you tried the beer?
I have. It's very nice. It's very nice. As, you know, you would hope hedgehog sort of suitable.
Hedgehog appropriate beer.
exactly what you want. And it's one of those sort of like really, really nice sort of sweet little sort of partnerships as well. I don't think many people would have automatically come to mind and thought beer company and hedgehogs, they need to be together. And then you see the campaign, you think, yes, you were correct.
Yeah, I would urge listeners to go to our website and check out this story. Just search for hedgehogs on our story and it'll come up. On our website and it'll come up because the pictures are very, very lovely. And it has been one of the most popular things on our website, isn't it?
Yeah, almost depressingly so.
Yeah. You can spend hours crafting beautiful features and in-depth, hard-hitting kind of exposés. And what do people want? They want hedgehogs. So, shall we get on with the podcast?
I think so.
Many of us will remember the days before online fundraising platforms. Anyone who was doing a sponsored activity for charity had to take around a clipboard and a pencil, collecting pledges for sponsorship and then go back to collect the money afterwards. Then in 2000, JustGiving arrived on the scene and changed all that. Instead of clipboards, pencils and having to meet face to face, sponsorship and any other kind of fundraising could be collected online through a simple link, which allowed donors to pledge, pay and share the page all in one go. Since then, the number of platforms has grown dramatically, with players of all sizes coming onto the market. Following the terror attacks and Grenfell fire in 2017, numerous people took to online giving platforms to offer their support and generosity to those affected. But there were also concerns about whether the money was going to the right places. Alongside that, there's also been the growth of crowdfunding platforms, which allow people to give money directly to another person to fund just about anything, a medical bill, a new business idea, an album. Some have argued that crowdfunding can bypass the traditional model of charitable giving, putting the power to raise funds directly in the hands of those who need it, while others have raised concerns about the lack of accountability. So what impact have online donation platforms had on charitable giving? What could crowdfunding mean for charities? And where can digital giving go next? I'm joined by Joe Barnett, Chief Executive of Virgin Money Giving, one of the biggest online fundraising platforms, Gerald Oppenheim, Chief Executive of the Fundraising Regulator and Chair of the London's Emergency Trust, and Marcus Misson, Director of Fundraising at WaterAid. So the last few years have seen an explosion in the number of online fundraising platforms available. What impact have they had on charities' ability to generate income?
I think they've had a positive effect in that it gives potential donors and supporters different ways of donating money. And I think a lot of charities, according to stats that the Institute of Fundraising has produced, a lot more charities recognise that their income from those sources is going up over time. So I think there is a positive effect there, and they're a force for good in that way.
Mm. And Marcus, sort of from your point of view at a charity?
I think building the point Joel's just made, I think it's really good because ultimately it gives more people more choices. It puts the control in the supporters' hands and I think it builds confidence. And I think it's something that we need to be adapting to as a sector. It's happening. It's reality. So we need to adapt to it.
Makes sense. And obviously, Joe, from your point of view, what you're working with the charities that you're serving on the platform, what kind of impact are you seeing?
Most charities now recognise they need a digital fundraising service. When we launched 10 and a half years ago, a lot of smaller charities didn't see it as core to what they were doing. Cash is obviously still prevalent. And actually what you see now is charities of all sizes embracing digital. That's the first thing. And then secondly, what you see is people using digital for more things. You know, when we first launched, it was largely event-based fundraising. InMem has taken off online. Corporate fundraising online has taken off. It's been a real diversification, both through platforms offering more services and also charities just getting more familiar with using them, really.
One other thing I'd add to that, I think with the more platforms there are, the better the technology will develop, the more investment there will be because it's more of a competitive market. But as well as that, the costs will come down as well.
Yeah, and you're right. It's a significantly more competitive market and competition is good. So it pushes everybody along. I agree.
Yeah, I mean, on that issue of cost, obviously, there used to be up until a couple of years ago, every year it would roll around in the Daily Mail and other newspapers that platforms were charging fees. And most platforms now, because of that kind of competition, don't charge fees or they might charge a membership fee or a joining fee for the charities. Do charities object to paying a percentage of the donation or paying these fees, and should they?
I think it's rubbish that they don't charge fees. I think it's smoke and mirrors. I think when you look at some of the changes that have gone on in the platforms, you can't run a resilient, well-regulated, effective platform with no budget. You just can't. And therefore, when people say they offer a free service, actually they're being disingenuous. If you take some of the biggest platforms, they have a tip where a donor might pay a 10 or 15% tip. That's still a fee. Mm. You know, they charge for gift aid collection. They might charge a monthly fee. They might charge higher card fees. So the reality is it should be as low cost as possible. It should be about getting the money to charities as quickly as possible. It should be about making that money safe. And it should be about having a really brilliant customer experience for the donors, for the charities and for the fundraisers. That would be my key thing, rather than whether it's free or not.
Mm. And I think, yeah, absolutely, in building on that, I think there's, fundamentally, it's about trust, isn't it? I think, you know, the reason why many supporters are engaging with these platforms, as already said, is around control, it's trust, it's the power in their hands. And so I think there needs to be a transparency around the fact that there are charges, they are commercial organisations, they need to make a profit, but it's the extent of profit and its excessiveness of the profit as well. And if we think in terms of the regulation of charities around, you know, we're working to stringent ROIs and ratios, then I think, you know, we need to also think in terms of what is the cost of that service and is it transparent to the supporter, but also recognising that actually the more profit these platforms can make, the more they can invest in innovation and the better the experience will be. So it's an ecosystem that we need to be realistic about, but the ultimate thing is that the supporter needs to know how much they're paying for the service they're getting.
It's that transparency point that was absolutely critical for us as a regulator of fundraising in starting to work with the biggest platforms, the best known platforms, and now a whole host of much smaller, less well known ones, but still raising money for charities and people are still using them. And it was about the fact that people at large didn't understand that there were fees that Virgin Money Giving or Just Giving or GoFundMe did not come free. And I remember, again, this is partly regulatory and partly London Emergencies trustee hat on here, you know, talking to people at Grenfell after the fire and the sudden realisation that people had down there, that a lot of members of the public were raising a lot of money to help them, but that some of the money was going in fees. I mean, it was the cause of the most amazing and quite understandable anger, because at that point, it was very difficult to find on websites that there was a fee, even if it was just the credit card processing fee. So that's why we and the Charity Commission started to work with the platforms to bring them into some regulation. And the driving force for us has been that charges should be made transparent for members of the public, because when you explain it, people understand.
And on the transparency note, I think there's another really important point. And I think many of the platforms, as Joel has been saying, are on top of this, but I suspect others aren't, which is transparency around data. From the point of view of, if I think in terms of WaterAid, from our perspective, we very much focus on engagement. We have an engagement strategy, and our approach to how we engage with supporters isn't transactional. It's very much about developing partners in the mission. It's very much about putting control in the supporters' hands. And this is something we really think hard about, and we're constantly trying to improve on. And I think when it comes to many of these platforms, let's be real, they're gathering data because they want to manage a relationship. And I think we need to have absolute clarity around, where's the data going? Is the relationship with the charity or not? Because more often than not, the data doesn't go to the charity. And just be really, really clear about that, because it's about the control of the supporter and the supporter having that control.
Our data always goes to the charity. but also, I'd like more charities to use it, ironically. So we have this really valuable asset that they can download from the site, and yet not enough of them are thinking, here are my potential long-term supporters, what can I do with it? So I'm all for data usage. Yeah.
Okay, and so what's the data you're collecting there?
Well, obviously when someone has a donor or a fundraiser, obviously when somebody does something like an event, a charity can pull off the reports, find out who the fundraiser is, build a relationship with that fundraiser. Similarly, a lot of donors give permissions so that you can then interact with the donor. A one-off donation could become a regular donation. So it's about taking that data, putting it in your systems, and then building a long-term value from them, really.
Gerald mentioned Grenfell and the terrorism tax in 2017. And obviously around that time, as well as kind of this concern about fees, there was a lot of concern that some of the pages might be fraudulent and that people with genuine motives and no expertise might end up with these kind of vast sums of money that they don't really know what to do with. Is that an issue that we've resolved now, do you think?
I wouldn't say it's necessarily resolved, but I think it's a lot in a lot of a better place than it was. At Grenfell in particular, London Bridge after the terror attack there, to some extent, people were incredibly generous in wanting to help, opening pages. A lot of people who knew them contributed. But what we found was that they hadn't thought through the end part of the process, which was, how do I get whatever I raise, whether it's £100 or £100,000, or in one case at Grenfell, over £1 million, from my page to the people I want to help? And a lot of work had to be done to deal with that, to help the individual opening the page specify a charity that might receive the funds, because it was a mix of wanting to help for charitable purposes and a crowdfund, in effect. But it worked out in the end, though at some cost to some of the individuals concerned, because certain people started trolling them, saying, what have you done with the money? You've run off with it. You're a fraud, and all those sort of very, very unpleasant things that nobody would want to have happen. So it is in a better place. I wouldn't want to say it was 100% resolved. It's much easier, of course, if you use a platform like Virgin that deals with charities, because in order to donate, you need to specify who you want the money to go to. And that's very straightforward. Where it's a crowdfund, it's more difficult. It's a bit more diffuse. People don't always specify. And I think, again, the work that we've done with crowdfunding sites has made that better, because they will step in and help now where it's not clear what's to happen.
Crowdfunding can be an amazing way to raise money. I personally don't believe it's the best way to spend the money. It doesn't quite work between your passion and in the moment raising of the money, to actually then having the ability, the governance, the expertise to necessarily spend that money really effectively. And it's a real disconnect. And as far as oversight is going, I mean, I work for a company that is ultimately owned by a bank. And we know, you know, do a lot on fraud and financial controls, and have looked long and hard at the crowdfunding market. You can't ever guarantee with the crowdfunding that the money will go to the cause of which it was intended. you can put lots of controls around it, but you don't know because you can't regulate it with that level of detail.
Yeah, and there are quite a lot of moral conundrums that are sort of thrown up by crowdfunding sites, that, you know, there's kind of wild and quite unfair inconsistencies between what attracts the funding and huge questions about what will happen to the money if it's not used for its intended purposes, either, as you're saying, Joe, with kind of something fraudulent, or where, you know, somebody, they've raised money for cancer treatment and the person hasn't survived long enough to take the treatment. Is there still a role there for charities as kind of honest and accountable brokers then, do you think?
Absolutely. And actually, I'd like to go back to the first question, or the previous question rather, because I think there's, let's face it, people are passionate and people want to do passionate things. Yeah. And, you know, and phoning up a charity and saying, like, I'm really passionate about your cause. How can I get involved? What's the best thing I can do? And a charity saying, take out a regular gift. It just doesn't do it, does it?
No.
So, which goes back to my point about the whole experience and engaging people in Partners of the Mission. So I think, you know, people will circumnavigate big charities and even small charities, and they would do their own thing. That's reality. I think, you know, going back to Gerald's point, that there are people who are doing this with best intentions. And I was reminding myself by looking on your website this morning, and there's some really good guidance. But also, let's recognise that there are people out there who don't do it for good intentions. And this is very open, because it's easy to fool people by tapping into their passion. And I think there is more that definitely needs to be done around that. And I think it's actually more about a wider society understanding of digital literacy and being more acutely aware of the fact that fraud does happen and being mindful of it. And it's not just for our sector, it's wider, but it's something we need to get on top of, because with machine learning, it's just going to get more and more and more and more and more. So I think that is an important issue that needs to be addressed. I don't think the three of us in the room can address it, but it needs to be addressed. Yeah. But then going back to your specific question, I think, you know, it's, and picking up on Joe's point, I think, you know, these crowdfunders the people who are using it, yeah, they're providing an end-to-end service. It's actually, I think what charities need to do is we need to modify and adapt and recognise the value we can provide within that end-to-end service. So it's not us competing against people who are doing their own thing. Absolutely not. But it's about what's the quality assurance we can provide. What's the best way of of making sure the funds go to where they need to go to. But that would require us looking at our model, adapting model, changing our model, and being really clear about, you know, that distinct value that no one else can provide.
I think that's right. Crowdfunding, as you've said, Marcus, does harness people's passion for a cause. It can go wrong, and it has done. I think we need to be careful about fraud, of course, always on the watch for that. But my experience of the leading platforms is that their anti-fraud processes are pretty good. Something will get through, because someone will always be a bit cleverer than your system. And it may take time to catch them, but they do tend to get caught. Incidents of fraud in all the recent cases are relatively low. And in fact, where they occur, they're more old-fashioned. They haven't been through using a platform. They've been through people presenting to other people as something that they're not, saying that they, you know, lived at Grenfell Tower when manifestly they didn't. That's old-fashioned fraud, and people get caught doing that. And we know that, six or seven people have been charged and sentenced as a result of being found guilty. So keep that in perspective. I think there are real benefits to it, as I've said. And if charities can provide that end-to-end service, that will help people. Because often people don't realise. And why should they, when they open a fundraising page, which is a crowdfunder, that what they might be doing, the more successful their page is in effect setting up a charitable trust with restricted beneficiaries at the other end. Now, that's horribly technical lawyer stuff, but that is what can happen. And people don't understand that. Why should they? They're not. You know, we're not a nation of charity lawyers. Some of my best friends are, but, we're not. We don't do it for that reason. Yeah. But sometimes those really technical things can catch people quite badly when they don't really understand the process.
Yeah, and I mean, jumping off from that, is there a way in which these kind of crowdfunding sites can be seen as competition? So rather than people setting up a charity off the back of it, is it competition for the traditional charity model?
I don't think so. Okay. I really don't think so. I think, you know, all competition's good. I think it's, as we already said, people want to do passionate things. People are passionate, they want to be passionate, and they want to do things, and they want to drive a difference and change. So I would see the emergence of crowdfunding as it's a challenge for the sector, which will drive the sector to adapt and change and modify. And so I think that's good. All competition is good. And let's accept, you know, the world is changing, and the nature of change is changing, and the speed of change is changing. And therefore, a traditional model, and it'd be interesting because that term traditional model, so many people have a different frame of reference in what's traditional, what's not. But I think the key thing is, you know, a transactional approach and some of the techniques that have been used by charities are long over the past the sell-by date, and we need to modify. As Gerald was talking, I was thinking, well, maybe there is a solution in the room here, because I think there's charities, going back to the point about, you know, absolutely all the big platforms have got really good fraud regulation and are very much on top of it. But I'm wondering whether, with the emergence of crowdfunding, there's something that the charities could modify their model to accommodate, but as well as the big platforms, because people are circumnavigating big platforms to do the crowdfunding. And that might be helpful services. It might be helpful tools, because you're right, Gerald, the country isn't full of charity lawyers. And I think as soon as we start putting the complication in, which is a complication we need, I think people will ignore it. So there's something there, but actually, how do we make it easier and more seamless for them?
And an example as well of how charities need to adapt is speed of which they get campaigns live. I mean, you take the floods or after a disaster, it's people that get on with it, while charities are still thinking through their governance and convening all the right people to set up a campaign or an appeal. So I think speed of activity on the charity side is having to adapt to respond to how quickly crowdfunders get going.
And I think that there's an interesting point in that, because rather than seeing it as, are these crowdfunders competing with charities, I'd hate us to be in a situation where charities are competing with people who are passionate, want to do passionate things. Mm-hmm. So I think there is something there that, you know, going back to the point about competition, to make a step back and look at it, because absolutely, you know, if people are activating the crowdfunding around flooding quicker than charities, then, you know, I wouldn't want to have a situation where charities are trying to get them up really quick to compete with these people. There's something about how do we engage them? How do we work together to drive the common purpose and the impact we all want to achieve in a way that's seamless, frictionless, that is as cost effective as possible, and is driving the impact that everyone wants.
One other aspect of the competition point, we get a lot of pretty, you know, young tech savvy people coming to us saying, I've got this great new idea for an app on your phone, which will raise much more money for charity. And you get a lot of really bright people developing apps that help people round up, as they're often called. So you spend, you know, £9.50 in the supermarket, and you decide you're going to put the other 50p into a charity, and you have an app on your phone where you can specify your favourite charities to get that 50p or that 1p from the £9.99 transaction. And the question I ask myself, and I don't think there's an answer to it at the moment because it's a bit too new, is whether that's going to encourage people to give more through the use of digital technology, or whether it's just going to sort of fragment what people give already, and it'll just spread through being given in different ways, or it might go down because you think, oh, I've rounded up on my phone, I'm not going to actually make that extra direct debit donation or put that money in a bucket.
We're looking at that all the time, as we're looking at new developments in terms of, you know, you think of contactless and how that's developing. That will have to be, everybody will have to have contactless in the coming months, never mind years. You think about things like text giving. We could never really get to the bottom. Why did that not take off? We all use text, you know, we all text, but text giving didn't grow the way it needed to. But I think the fact that you can now do so many more things means it won't all be incremental, but there is a lot more incremental. If I think of some of the partnerships that we're talking to around how you can bring other money from other markets into online giving. If you think of retail and what happens there in terms of the cashback and shopping through some of those sites. So I think more and more it will grow as charities just see digital as a core part of their what they're offering. And so they push their supporters into those different sort of channels.
I think in the here and now, so I look at this in two perspectives. I think in the here and now, yes, it's going to divert some funding. Fine. So the pot is growing it's an incremental growth. It's a small growth. But I think really, picking up Joe's point, there's loads of new technologies coming out. There's loads of bright ideas. Some will fail. Some won't. Some of them are ahead of where consumers' behaviour is, and you know, the attitude and the trust to these things. But I think you know, very much the way we look at this is it's the future. If we think in terms of tomorrow's supporter, they're not going to give a direct debit. So why do we keep long tailing an old fashioned model? And also, not only that, the whole premise of the Victorian premise of people give alms, they do good. That is not so relevant for future generations. So I think there is something about frictionless giving, frictionless support, which is part of their everyday lives, as opposed to something different and tangential, which is which contrasts with their actual behaviour. So I think absolutely, if we don't adapt, we're not going to be maximising the future.
I think that seems like a really good place to leave it, actually. Thank you very much for joining us, everybody. I should mention, you can find out more about this issue, particularly on looking at the crowdfunding and the ethics around crowdfunding, in the next edition of Third Sector magazine, so look out for that. Earlier this month, Third Sector held its first ever Charity Tech Summit. The event aimed to help charities rethink leadership skills for the digital age, tap into the enormous potential of both current and emerging tech to create a lasting impact, and to address the digital skills gap to increase their organisational capability. While I was there, I caught up with Zoe Ammer, founder and director of the consultancy Zoe Ammer Digital and chair of the charity Digital Code, to find out what progress is being made. The idea of a digital skills gap in charities has been an area of concern for a number of years now. So I asked Zoe whether there are still barriers to understanding.
It's a really good question, because I certainly think the conversation around digital is changing. So the very fact that you're having a tech summit here today, the very fact that there is now a charity digital code of practice, that there are some great charities out there who we'll be hearing from today, from Children's University to Parkinson's UK, are doing amazing work, says to me that things are beginning to change. My reading of the sector, though, as with any other industry, is that change is still quite slow. So if we look at the Charity Digital Skills Report, which we co-author year on year, it's a kind of annual barometer of where the charity sector's at with digital. There are some very small incremental changes happening, but at the same time, there's quite a long way to go in terms of, for example, skilling up boards and helping leaders be more confident in digital as well. And I think those are two of the big missing pieces of the puzzle.
One of the things that's come up today quite a few times has been this conversation about digital for the sake of digital. And there's a feeling that, yeah, we must have a digital strategy in place. How do you avoid that and kind of make sure that we're looking at digital with a purpose?
So the fundamental question there, so as Helen O'Donnell from Children's University talked about when I interviewed her, is that you really need to go back to your vision and mission. And they should really be your North Star in what you're trying to do with digital. There's no point investing lots of money in fancy tech and AI and machine learning if you're not ultimately clear at the end of the day about how it's all going to help you achieve your charitable purpose, what you were really set up to do. So that should partly be a guide for your strategy and clearly for your investment decisions too.
You are the chair of the Charity Digital Code, so tell us about the Charity Digital Code and what it is and what you're hoping to achieve with it.
The Charity Digital Code of Practice was launched back at the end of 2018. It's a framework essentially to help charities improve their skills in digital, to increase their impact, and ultimately to be more sustainable. And we've been doing some really exciting work behind the scenes on the code over the last few months, where we've been talking to some amazing charities who are using the code, and we're also currently redeveloping the website as well to create a better user experience. So we will be talking about that more as we get into March, and that is very much a free resource to help charities who are struggling with stuff or who are even doing it really well and want to benchmark where they're at and look at how they can do it better. And we were really pleased last year to see in the Digital Skills Report that 43% of respondents said that they were already using the code, and we've got some great case studies such as NSPCC, World Vision, small charities such as Talk, Listen, Change already starting to engage with the code and see some benefits from it. So I'm looking forward to saying more about that as we get into the spring.
You've talked a little bit about it, but what impact is the digital code having so far?
So what we're hearing from the charities who are using it is that it's basically helping them understand where they are at, because obviously the code very much features best practice for small and large charities. And I think that's an area which is a big challenge for a lot of organisations, not just charities actually, is are we doing this stuff well? Are we not doing it well? In my experience, people often either underrate where they're at or perhaps overrate it. So giving them a guide on how they're performing and where they need to improve things, I think, is really key. And what you can expect for different sizes of organisation. It's also a really useful tool. We've worked with quite a few charity CEOs now who are really wanting to demonstrate their authority and credibility when it comes to digital. And even if as a CEO you just sat down and read perhaps the principle leadership, I think you'd have a clearer idea of what is expected of a leader in the digital age and how you lead a modern charity. And then we're seeing some great charities as well who are also kind of signposting to it as a resource when they are organisations who are helping other organisations as well. So we're seeing some really interesting stories out there about how it's starting to make a difference for charities. I'm looking forward to sharing more of those this year.
Brilliant. And where can people find out more about the Charity Digital Code?
So it's over on charitydigitalcode.org. Just to mention, as I said, we're redeveloping the website, so it's going to look a bit different in a few weeks' time. Looking forward to sharing that with everyone.
The British Asian Trust announced this month that it had appointed the singer Katy Perry as an ambassador, saying Perry would have a particular focus on supporting BAT's work in reducing child trafficking across India over the next 5 years. The charity came under fire on Twitter, with several people objecting to the fact that Perry was white. But the British Asian Trust stood by their decision, pointing out that Perry was the only one of the Trust's 33 ambassadors who was not Asian. But it doesn't always work out that way. In January, actor Brian Cox was asked to stand down as a patron of Midland Daycare Centre, which is based in Dundee, a city with an allegedly significant drug problem, after saying that everybody should smoke pot. We're joined by Paul Cullen, a charity celebrity management consultant, to find out more about what a patron can offer a charity and when it's time to say goodbye. Can we start with what can celebrity patrons, ambassadors, do for a charity?
I think with celebrity ambassadors and patrons, there's a number of ways in which they can support, but principally you want them to be communicating about your charity. So not everything they do will be PR and media, nor will it be fundraising, but actually you'll be using them in some way to use their platform to talk about the charity. So that might be to your prospective corporate partners, your major donors. You can use them in lobbying politicians. A lot of charities will have events at Parliament where they ask their ambassadors to go along. Also, events are a major kind of way of both raising awareness about the charity, but also impacting on fundraising. If you take the example of Scott Mitchell, who is Barbara Windsor's husband, who chose to run last year's London Marathon as part of Dementia Revolution, along with some of Barbara's former EastEnders co-stars, that has become the London Marathon's most successful Charity of the Year partnership ever in its history, and has raised over £4 million. So there's a number of ways that you can work with them, and there's kind of four kind of P's of celebrity support: participation, profile, pathways to networks, and then philanthropy. And they're kind of ever decreasing circles. So a lot of celebrities will donate their time through participating in things, but then you will have some that will actually either use their own income to donate to the charity or be able to leverage the support of their fans in supporting the charity and doing things such as celebrity edition TV shows.
And how should a charity choose a patron? Should the patron be someone who has a connection with the charity's cause, or someone who helped the charity reach a new audience?
Primarily, you really want somebody to to approach somebody who's got that connection to the cause. There is and has become quite a lot of cynical thoughts around celebrities being involved with charities. So there's always scrutiny around that relationship. So the more that you're able to identify that the celebrity has a genuine reason for being involved is great, and it gives that element of authenticity. So if you're putting them in front of a TV camera to talk about your cause, if they've got that personal experience, then they're able to just talk about it without really being briefed hugely by the charity. But given the way that charities need to approach new audiences and engage with new audiences, you might find that that person that is key to get into that audience might not have that personal first-hand experience. But then you need to look at what you can do to introduce the charity to that person and give them a bit more of a first-hand experience. So are you able to visit a service that you provide or get them to talk to people that you support? And then from that, they're able to kind of build a much more in-depth and informed opinion about what you do. So when they question about it, they're very confident about what they're talking about.
And what are the dangers for charities when their patrons hit the headlines for the wrong reasons?
I think one of the biggest problems for charities is actually a knee-jerk reaction to whatever the patron has been accused of. I don't think, in my personal opinion, that when a celebrity hits the headlines for a particular reason, people first of all go, oh, I wonder what charity they support. So It's really about kind of, you know, wondering or deciding whether you're part of that conversation to begin with.
And what can charities do to mitigate the dangers of that happening?
The key thing about mitigating any risks associated with celebrities is first and foremost research. So research is the foundation stone for any work that you'll do with celebrities. So you will want to research why they're involved in the charity or why you want to get them involved in the charity. Is there an existing connection? And when you're doing that, you need to look at what have they done in the past? What negative press have they generated? Is that likely to impact on your charity? And if it is, then you need to question whether that's the person that you should be working with first and foremost. But when you're working with somebody, and obviously you're not going to find out everything about a celebrity you're working with, and things can come up that nobody would have thought of, it's about having some sort of plan in place. So a bit of a crisis comms plan to be able to deal with that effectively. So A, first of all, are you actually involved in that conversation? If you're not, then don't involve yourself in it at all. Steer well clear. If it's an issue which is related to what your charity does, so if, for example, you're a dependency support charity and the celebrity is arrested for drink driving or something similar, then obviously the media may well turn to you, first of all, for a comment. So it's establishing kind of the facts as much as you can, remembering that your celebrity has donated quite a lot of time probably to support in the cause, and that they're actually still one of your key allies. So you need to understand what they're coming from, the position they're coming from, and talk to their agent and talk to them if possible. But remember first and foremost that you almost have a duty of care to the celebrity, and you know, it may well be an accusation that's very much, you know, magnified in the press that actually comes to nothing in the end. So it's duty care to your supporter first and foremost.
And I suppose following on from that last point, sort of what should charities weigh up when deciding whether to stand by their patron in sort of a moment of crisis or whether to cut all ties?
I mean, when you talk about patrons, it tends to be patrons tend to be royal more or less with the majority of charities. And so if you look at the case of Prince Andrew, for example, because one of the key functions of the royals is patronage of charities, then the media are going to go straight first and foremost to look at who do they support, and you know where, and will ask for a response from that charity as to whether they should cut ties. With most people, you need to really understand whether that what they're being accused of is going to have any impact on you at all. So it goes back to understanding, actually, is it a conversation that you're going to be part of? Are the media actually interested in your side of the, you know, your involvement with them? Or more importantly, are your donors and potential supporters actually going to understand that that celebrity is already involved in a charity. Obviously, celebrities are able to amplify the message of charities massively, but I don't necessarily think that once they hit the headlines for a wrong reason, everyone is literally going to go, oh, well, they support X charity, and therefore that's going to impact on your involvement or the support that you're going to get. So it's having celebrity as part of your reputation management plans and your crisis comms, and coming up with a consistent message. So whether that message is following whatever the agent of the celebrity or the publicist has put out about how they're dealing with it, that's always a good way to kind of get a steer on the narrative that you should really be looking to follow.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
We'll be back with another episode next month, so make sure you subscribe to this, the Third Sector podcast, on your favourite podcast app to be the first to know about it.
Thank you again to Joe Barnett, Marcus Misson, Gerald Oppenheim, Zoe Ammer, and Paul Cullen for joining us, to the producer, Anushka Tate, for Rethink Audio, and to you for listening.